is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Arab Spring brought hope and promise to the Middle East, but most of that has evaporated. We've seen uprising in country after country with little to nothing to show for those who wanted change. Syria is embroiled in a terrible civil war in which the U.S. says we have incontrovertible evidence that the Assad regime used chemical weapons against innocent civilians. Citizens of Egypt were successful in deposing longtime dictator Hosni Mubarak and holding democratic elections, only to have another uprising overturn that democratically elected leader. Now the military controls the government and the turmoil continues. In almost all of these conflicts, the West looks on wondering what, if anything, they can or should do, and we have great difficulty understanding the roots of all these problems. That's probably because we don't look back far enough. Our guest today suggests we need to go back as far as the Middle Ages if we want to truly understand today's problems and what the future may hold. Dr. Jonathan Berkey is the James B. Duke Professor of International Studies and Chair of the History Department at Davidson College, and he's back with us again for the hour. Thank you for being here.
Nice to be here, Mike.
many of us, and as I said, in the West saw the Arab Spring as something filled with promise for a new and different and probably more peaceful Middle East, a better Middle East, at least in our point of view. That has not turned out to be the case, and it was a surprise to many of us. Did you ever believe that the Arab Spring held that promise?
Oh, sure, it held that promise. I mean, there's no question that the Arab Spring, what we've called the Arab Spring, the series of uprisings in Libya and Egypt and Syria and elsewhere, have been in part the story of a oppressed, frustrated people seeking to create for themselves a democratic, liberal political order. No question, that's part of the story, but it's only a very small part of the story.
Why were they oppressed? All these areas, all these countries in the Middle East seem to have very strong leaders, no democracy to speak of, even though they, some of them, like Hosni Mubarak, claimed he was a democratic leader. He was not.
No.
Why?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that, and it would take a long time for us to go over them all. But the point should be made that really since the end of the Second World War, this whole region has been under the sway of governments which have been authoritarian in various ways. They are by and large been regimes that were rooted in one way or another in the military in those countries, and there are reasons why the military has been sort of the cutting edge of political change in that region. But what we're really sort of witnessing, I think, right now is the collapse of that old order. And that's what's thrown everything into turmoil. It's true in Libya. It's true in Egypt and Syria, in Iraq, in part thanks, of course, to the American invasion. And that whole authoritarian order is now collapsing.
Did we start it by toppling Saddam Hussein?
I don't think we started it, because I think the roots of this go back earlier. The major turning point, I think, or I would point to two things. And one is the Six-Day War in 1967, which began the process of discrediting these military-based authoritarian regimes that have dominated the region. And then the other thing was the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1978-79, which one has to be careful about, because, of course, Iran is different. It's not an Arab state. It's a Shiite state. But still, the revolution there in overthrowing an authoritarian government rooted in the military showed that it was possible to create a different kind of political order. And I think really that was kind of the point of inflection that set all this in motion. And through our invasion of Iraq in 2003, we expedited the process in at least one part of the world, but it's deeper than that.
But as these regimes tumble or have the underpinnings knocked out from under them and they begin to become weaker and weaker, what we're seeing is not a rise of democracy as we thought we might see as the people come to the forefront and demand change. What we're seeing is, or at least percolating under the surface of all this, is a rise of fundamentalist Islam and a fight between the two major sects, Sunni and Shiite, it seems to me, which has been going on, it seems, for a long time. Has this tension between Sunni and Shiite been going on for centuries?
Well, you've raised two huge and distinct topics. I mean, on the one hand, you raised the question of Islamic fundamentalism, and that's something we can talk about. As for the distinction between Sunni and Shi'i Islam, There is a real difference between them, and the differences are deep. They're very historical. The difference between a Sunni and a Shi'i really has nothing to do with radicalism or anything like that. It has to do with how you feel about certain events that took place in Islamic history in the 7th century and how an Islamic society should be ordered. There are people who talk about events in the Middle East these days as part of a long-term process of a Shiite resurgence. And there are places in which that's true. It's certainly true in Iran. It's especially true in Iraq. The situation in Iraq is that you have a population which is about 60% Shiite, and that population was for centuries, first under the Ottomans, then under the British, then under the Iraqi military, then under Saddam Hussein, dominated by a small Arabic-speaking Sunni elite. And what the American invasion in 2003 did, whatever else it accomplished, it overthrew that political order in which the country was dominated by an Arabic-speaking Sunni minority and placed it under the control of the majority Shiite population. Next door in Syria, exactly the opposite is happening. Syria since 1970 has been dominated by Alawites. Now, Alawites are not exactly Shiites. Virtually all Sunnis and most Shiis would say that the Alawites aren't even Muslim, but the Alawite religion does kind of grow out of Shiism, and the Alawites in Syria have been allied with Shiite movements in Lebanon and Iran and elsewhere. So in Syria, you're having exactly the opposite experience. There, Syria has been dominated by this a Sunni Muslim majority has been dominated since 1970 by this kind of Shiite-like religious group, and the uprising there is in part an effort to overthrow that order and to establish rule by the Sunni Arab majority.
Very complicated.
It's very complicated.
Were the dictatorships that have been in place for decades were they responsible for keeping much of this conflict between Sunni and Shiite and Alawite and other sects in check?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Saddam Hussein was a pretty nasty man, but his regime did, to a large degree, keep this kind of rivalry in check. Now, you shouldn't lead to the conclusion that Sunnis and Shiis are necessarily always at each other's throat. No. I mean, historically, that's not true. There have been many places, many times and places in Islamic history where Sunnis and Shiis have gotten along perfectly well together.
Iraq's a good example.
But under Saddam Hussein, and yes, those tensions were kept in check in a brutal, brutal way.
Well, how do you explain Iraq, for instance? We know that Sunni and Shiite lived next door to each other. They married each other.
They did. There was a fair amount of communication and, shall we say, cross-fertilization between sectarian communities.
He goes away, thanks to us, and the whole thing falls apart. Why?
Right. Well, in part it's because of the way in which the American authorities, in the wake of the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime, set up the new political order. In various ways, encouraged the creation of a system in which people tended to identify themselves politically by their sectarian identity. You know, certain positions were allotted to the Shi'i community, and certain positions were allotted to the Sunni community. And all that was designed in a way to protect the rights of religious minorities, but had the effect of encouraging people to think of themselves politically first and foremost as Sunnis or Shiis or what have you.
This may sound like a silly question given what we know about what's going on as an undercurrent and sometimes at the top of the list, religion. How important is religion to the function of any state in that part of the world?
Well, I think it's very important. People in the Middle East take their religion very seriously. As a New England Yankee who's moved to the South, several decades ago, people here take their religion pretty seriously too. I don't think it's especially unusual in that regard. And it's also important to say that these kind of military regimes, the authoritarian regimes that I talked about a few moments ago as having dominated this part of the world since the end of the Second World War, those regimes, all of them, were really very secular in orientation. They were dominated by the military, secular in orientation. They embraced an ideology of secular nationalism. And one of the things that's collapsing in a way now is that secular order. And what you alluded to earlier is this: the apparent rise of Islamic fundamentalism is really just part of a larger process whereby lots of different political ideas are in competition to replace that now discredited secular nationalist political order.
What are the other ideas?
Well, there are real liberal democratic movements. Certainly in Egypt, there's a very strong kind of liberal, a very strong, very active, very vocal liberal, what we would call a liberal democratic with a small d, political movement. It's complicated there, however, by very, very bad relations between that liberal community and the Muslim Brotherhood and the various other Islamist groups, as a result of which the liberal Democrats have, by and large, been quite supportive of the military reasserting its authority in the face of the Islamist government.
Let's talk about Egypt for a sec. The people of Egypt rose up several years ago against Hosni Mubarak, whose name I have difficulty saying. I don't know why. But they rose up against him, and they, against all odds, were successful at deposing him.
Just an amazing thing what happened.
And then they held an election which, to outsiders, appeared to be very democratic, and they elected a leader, Mohamed Morsi, from the Islamic Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, and he lasted about a year, and they rose up again and were successful again in deposing the leader they elected. And all this happened very quickly. How do you explain
that? Well, the election which brought Morsi to power was democratic in a sense, but there were some real problems with it. One of them is that it would be a mistake, I think, to look at the electoral support that the Muslim Brotherhood-backed candidate, Mohamed Morsi, received as necessarily an indication that a majority of Egyptians were in favor of radical Islam or an Islamist political order. The Muslim Brotherhood had a degree of legitimacy and spoke with a degree of authority, in part because under the period of Hosni Mubarak's rule, it had been the one political organization in Egypt that really did stand up to the authoritarian and very unpopular government. And consequently, it had a kind of, I think, legitimacy and authority amongst people at large. And people voted for it in part as an expression of hope for the future, not necessarily as an expression of support for an Islamist political order. The second thing you have to remember is that there was a runoff, right? There were a lot of people running at first, and then there was a runoff. And the candidate against whom Morsi ran in the runoff was and was perceived to be a throwback to the old regime. Mm-hmm. He had been a part of the old political order, and a lot of people were just totally put off by that. Here was a Hobson's choice. It was nothing. Either you vote for the Muslim Brotherhood-backed candidate or you vote for this guy who came right out of Hosni Mubarak's political order. And so I think the democratic groups in Egypt, the liberal groups, were really, really kind of deflated by this.
So when he gets into power, and it becomes apparent, or at least it is interpreted by some within the citizenry of Egypt, that this guy is trying to make it an Islamist state or whatever it was that they were upset with him, they get rid of him, and the liberal Democrats favor the military rule.
Not entirely, but to a large degree. It wasn't just that Morsi was seeking to create a kind of an Islamist political order. It's that he was being very kind of ham-fisted in the way in which he went about distributing power within the government, really kind of closed people off and created a system that was not at all representative of the people.
Dr. Jonathan Berkey is our guest with Davidson College. We're going to come back and talk more about the Middle East and the roots of the conflict that we see there now in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, introducing the all-new redesigned 2014 Forester, providing more legroom and rear cargo space, a CVT transmission, and up to 32 mpg. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. Porsche by Design opens Saturday, October 12th. The exhibition explores the Porsche design legacy with 22 cars from the 1930s to present day. NCArtMuseum.org. We talk talk to two very different styles of music making, or talk about two very different styles of music making. In the Queen City tomorrow, we start with Latin music, which will be center stage during the upcoming Latin Music Festival in October. We'll talk to the cultural events director of the Latin American Coalition. And then we have a conversation with a local up-and-coming DJ duo who have been working for years to perfect their sound. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, House Republicans pass a bill to cut $39 billion from food stamp programs, the politics of food stamp spending.
You can join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Jonathan Berkey is with us, the chair of the Department of History at Davidson College, author of The Formation of Islam, Religion, and Society in the Near East, 600 to 1800. And he's writing a new book called The Shattered Mosaic, The Middle East Since the Rise of Islam.
Right.
And I'd like to get into the Middle East prior to the rise of Islam at some point in this hour.
Sure.
He's going to be speaking to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte about Egypt and Syria Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at Parker Poe Adams and Bernstein. You can find more information about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. What happened in Egypt with the rise of the military and the ouster of Mohamed Morsi was, you say, a coup d'etat, and yet the United States has been very careful in not characterizing it like that because we are not allowed to support governments that have been overthrown militarily.
Well, if we labeled it a coup d'etat, then we would have to circumscribe the aid that goes to Egypt, mostly military aid, and that the perception is that that would destabilize the regime further. And the regime has very close ties, of course, to the United States. I mean, Sisi himself, General Sisi, studied at the War College in Pennsylvania. So he
and we've had close ties with the Egyptian military, which is which to me makes this more disturbing. Why would the military be interested in taking over? Why did they let out Hosni Mubarak from prison? Why have they kept Morsi in at least incommunicado, if not in prison? Why?
Well, the military in Egypt is more than a military. The military is really a kind of a classic example of what President Eisenhower famously referred to as a military-industrial complex. The military has been the dominant institution in Egyptian political life since the early 1950s. It has acquired for itself connections to and control over and ownership over a significant portion, probably as much as 40% of the Egyptian economy represents output by industries that are controlled by or owned by the military. It's one of the major landowners in Egypt. And so what a radically new government posed was a threat to this very, very broad and complex web of interests that the senior officers in the military have.
What did the people of Egypt think would happen if they were successful in toppling Morsi?
Well, one needs to be careful to think about any sort of generalizations about the people.
Mm-hmm.
Although it is significant that in Egypt,
what did they want?
Well, I was going to say it's interesting that if you listen to the chanting sort of that went on in the Tahrir Square demonstrations and in other Arabic-speaking countries too, the standard chant was Shab Yurid something or other. The people want something or other. It was all about what they wanted. To generalize about what they wanted would be very difficult. Some clearly wanted an Islamist political order. Others wanted a kind of a liberal democratic political order with free elections and free political parties and a free press. Mostly what I think people in Egypt wanted was a chance to live a meaningful and comfortable and productive life. The Egyptian economy is a real shambles. And you have just whole generations of people who have had no opportunity to not just to express themselves, but to live meaningful, productive, economically rewarding lives.
And they have a lot of educated people who don't have jobs.
Let me tell you, Mike, there are real demographic pressures in Egypt. When I first went to Egypt in 1981, the population of the country just passed 38 million. There are now maybe 84, 85 million people in the country. So it's more than doubled in just about three decades. Those people live in an incredibly concentrated area. You look at a map and Egypt is this huge country, mm-hmm. right? But 97% of it is uninhabitable desert. Those 84, 85 million people are crammed into an area roughly the size of southern New England, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island,
wow.
a very, very small space. And because the population has grown so rapidly, many of them are very young. And the schools, the educational system is a mess. And these people come out of a bad educational system, and they have very little in the way of job opportunities. A lot of this has to do with just basic human and economic frustration.
How do they survive?
Well, one of the problems is that the principal mechanism for survival in Egypt, one of the principal mechanisms is government handouts. You know, the government subsidies
and
of basic things like
money,
bread and
where
fuel.
Where does that money come from if the economy is in shambles?
Well, in part from three major sources, one from foreign aid, one from remittances from Egyptians working abroad in the Gulf in particular, and thirdly, from tourism. And of course, tourism is a mess right now.
Sure.
The tourist sector has pretty much collapsed. So there are real economic pressures. Where's the money come from? They don't really have the money right now. And as a result of that, there's terrible inflation and the value of the Egyptian pound, the Egyptian currency has collapsed.
When many Americans think of the Middle East and they think of the problems there, they think of Islam as being the problem. That's mm-hmm. what the problem is, because that's where the terrorists come from. And that's not necessarily true, and we know that there's a lot of peaceful Muslims. But prior to the rise of Islam, and this is going back centuries, what was society like there?
Prior to the rise of Islam?
Yeah.
In the 7th century?
What gave rise to it? How do you explain the rise of Islam? What made it attractive?
What made it attractive and encouraged people in the Middle East to convert to Islam is that it was successful. Islam began as a religious movement amongst the Arabs of the Arabian Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what we mean by Arabs when we talk about people in the 7th century is not what we would mean by the term Arab today. Today, an Arab is just anyone who speaks Arabic. It could be Moroccan, an Algerian, an Egyptian, a Syrian, an Iraqi, whatever. But the Arabs originally were a tribal nomadic people from the Arabian Peninsula. And there was this religious movement among them, a monotheistic religious movement associated with this man named Muhammad, which came to be identified as Islam in the first half of the 7th century. And for a whole host of reasons, which I don't think you want us to go into right now, they burst out of Arabia into the Middle East and were enormously successful in conquering territory from the two principal states at the time, the Sasanian Empire of Iran and the Byzantine Empire, which is what was left of the old Roman Empire. And because they were successful in conquering this huge swath of territory, people were attracted to it. You know, people love a winner. And there was kind of an elegance, I think, to Muslim theology. It was very similar to Jewish theology and Christian theology, the religions of the people of the region. And so over time, it takes several centuries, three or four centuries, but over time, a majority of the people in the region willingly, you know, voluntarily embraced Islam. The notion that the kind of the fantasy that people have, this image of Islam having spread by the sword, of having offered people the choice of conversion or death, this is historically inaccurate.
And what is it about either Islam or that part of the world where and even Western societies are guilty of this? I want to preface the mm-hmm. question by saying that all you have to do is look to West Virginia and the Hatfields and McCoys to point the finger at ourselves. Mm-hmm. But what is it about that part of the world that causes lingering, simmering resentments which cannot be solved?
Well, I think – all right. This is I think, a point that I would stress in part because it's the subject of that book that you mentioned that I'm trying to finish up mm-hmm. Right now. The Middle East from the get-go, you know, for the last several thousand years, is and always has been an extraordinarily diverse place.
Okay.
It really was multicultural in a way that we are only now beginning to imagine and to experience ourselves. And by and large, in the pre-modern period, people in the Middle East developed fairly effective mechanisms and institutions for dealing with that diversity. They were institutions and mechanisms which, from a modern perspective, we might not like, but at the time, they actually worked pretty well. And the idea that all of that difference in diversity was always erupting in violence and conflict is just is historical nonsense. What's happened in the last 200 years is that the political situation in which people in the Middle East operate has changed, in part because of the intrusion of outside political movements and ideologies, many of them borrowed from the West. And when I, as a medieval historian, my research interests are mostly medieval, but when I, as a medieval historian, look at the modern history of the Middle East over, say, the last 200 years, what I see is a situation in which that difference in diversity, that multiculturalism, is slowly being squeezed out, in which a series of political movements, starting with the various forms of nationalism that came to be dominant in the 19th and the early 20th centuries, and now finally the kind of the religious revivalist movements as well, all of them have in common is a tendency to insist upon a certain kind of cultural, maybe religious, political identity that should be homogeneous. And all that heterogeneity, all that difference and diversity is kind of being squeezed out.
So are you saying that the people who want these places to become – to live by Islam are longing for a time that never existed? Not unlike what's happening in this country, where we look back to the 1950s as this idyllic time in American life where the middle class was on the rise and everybody had the house with the picket fence and the 3.2 kids and lived like Leave It to Beaver. It never really
Absolutely.
Existed.
There's an element of kind of romantic nostalgia about in the Islamist vision, which is very much at odds with social and political realities of the period that they fantasize about.
Because you talk about it, and some many people from that part of the world point to the fact that they created our numbers system. They created.
Well, they borrowed it actually from India, but yes.
Okay. But they were responsible. That part of the world was responsible for a great deal of our intellectual.
Ninth and tenth centuries. This was far and away the most intellectually vibrant part of the world.
But that kind of development could not have happened, could it? If they had been fundamentally Islamic.
They were deeply Islamic. What they were not is fundamentally Islamic. And this, if by fundamentally Islamic we mean the kind of Islam that is embraced mm-hmm. by the radicals like the Al-Qaeda folk. I mean, mm-hmm. they are living a kind of a fantasy life about the roots of the religion. No. I mean, it was Islam which in many ways encouraged the kind of rich cultural life of the 9th and 10th centuries and all that you're sort of alluding to here. But it was a very different kind of world than the one that's imagined by the radicals in the contemporary period.
How are they getting it wrong?
Well, how are they getting it wrong? They're imagining a kind of uniformity to the Islamic tradition that simply is not historically the case. They imagine that Islam means this or Islam means that. They have a very kind of simplistic understanding of what Islam requires, whereas in fact, historically, Islam has been a very, very broad and flexible religious tradition, one that's embraced lots of different ideas, new ideas, that's been willing to tolerate a fair amount of diversity and difference, even within the parameters of what constitutes Islam.
Why are the stakes so high for those who would like to see this kind of society established and who see these opportunities, the toppling of these dictators, as opportunities to bring that kind of society to fruition? Why are the stakes so high?
Well, in part, there are a lot of reasons, I think. Part of it has to do with a frustration at what they perceive to be a corruption of their own traditions through the intrusion of Western ideas, Western models, Western culture, Western movies, Western ways of dress, Western ways of arranging families and gender relations. I mean, this is true of kind of right-wing reactionary religious movements in many societies, including our own. There's kind of a perception that this world that they imagine is under threat, that it's under attack, and that gives rise to tremendous anxiety. But it's very similar to, I think, what has been going on in our own society for the last three or four decades, with the rise of kind of fundamentalist right-wing groups as well.
Well, as that part of the world tends to want to contract what is acceptable, the West seems to be pushing the envelope constantly, even to some Western eyes.
Yes.
What has happened in the last 20 years
absolutely
has been untenable to many people.
Sure, you think about gender relations, gender identity, you know, and the ways in which we have sort of expanded our understanding
language,
of that.
Dress, what is acceptable in
right.
polite society has all changed to a great, great degree, which begs the question, are our two worlds compatible? And we seem to be, in an electronic age, beaming images and thoughts and ideas all across the world, and that's got to be terribly
intrusive. I think you're absolutely right that the circumstances of the modern world and the ease with which ideas and images and all can move from place to place sets up an incredibly anxious moment for people. And what the consequences of this are going to be, you know, your guess is as good
as
mine.
And does that cause them to – I'm not sure of the right word. Does that cause people who want to protect their Islamic identity
– what they perceive to be their Islamic right, identity.
– to yeah. harden their position.
Absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
They feel they have to harden it to protect themselves.
These are reactionary movements, and that's the definition of a reactionary movement. Yeah.
If we were to – if oil was not a factor, and that is the factor.
If oil was not a factor?
Yes. If oil was not a factor, would we even notice them? Would we even be involved in the Middle East? Would that solve some of the problems that they're
facing? Well, oil is a factor, although often not in the ways that Americans imagine. I mean, we really, for example, in the United States don't get any oil from the Middle East, not to speak of, not vast amounts. But what Middle Eastern oil does is – it goes to the international market, and if you took it out,
yeah.
then the price of oil everywhere would go up. So it is a factor there.
And when I say the West, I don't mean just the United States.
No, of course, right. It's hard to play counterfactual games, but there is no doubt that our concerns for the region and our interests in the region are to some degree conditioned by, shaped by the role that oil plays in the area's politics and its kind of strategic significance.
But I guess the question is, would we be perceived less as an infidel or as an infiltrator of their society if we had no economic interest in the oil that they have? Or would we still be perceived that way because in this day and age of electronic media and the internet, our images, our thoughts, our ideas would still be available?
I think we would be perceived as infidels because you're absolutely right. Those images and all would be there. But it might not matter so much. Mm-hmm. If we were infidels, perceived by some to be infidels, well, so what? The problem for us is that we have other political interests. For example, our support for Israel that creates real conflict between us and certain communities, other communities in the Middle East.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about Syria with Dr. Jonathan Berkey, who's the James B. Duke Professor of International Studies and the Chair of the History Department at Davidson College. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Latin School, with the kindergarten admissions open house October 3rd at 7 p.m. and an open house for all grades October 17th at 9:30 a.m. Registration at 704-846-7207. And the Charlotte Symphony begins its classics season Friday and Saturday. Christopher Warren Green conducts Holst's The Planets and Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 2 at the Belk Theater. Tickets at charlottesymphony.com. House.org. House Republicans passed a bill to cut $39 billion from food stamp programs. They'll explore the politics of food stamp spending on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. Our guest today, Dr. Jonathan Berkey, is speaking at the World Affairs Council at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday at Parker Poe Adams and Bernstein. You can get information about that at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks, where you can also join our conversation this morning.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait, because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap Judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it. Saturdays at 8 p.m. or Fridays at 10 p.m. on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Jonathan Berkey is our guest from Davidson College, author of The Formation of Islam, Religion and Society in the Near East, 600 to 1800. And he's writing a book called Shattered Mosaic, The Middle East Since the Rise of Islam. One of the victims of the conflict in Egypt and also the conflict in Syria and probably in other places around that region, as these forces struggle for supremacy, have been the Coptic Christians. This is a 2,000-year-old sect of Christianity that has, I believe, pretty much peacefully coexisted with people in the Islamic world for a long, long time.
Well, in Egypt in particular. Copts are specifically Egyptian.
And now not so much. What has changed?
Well, that's kind of what I was going on about a little bit before. I mean, one of the real tragedies of what's going on right now is the way in which minority communities, ethnic communities, but especially religious communities in various places are coming under new pressure as a result of all the political turmoil. And as you point out, these are communities that have in various ways coexisted and generally coexisted pretty well with their neighbors, with the surrounding majoritarian culture for thousands of years. And in Egypt, in Syria, in Iraq, these minority communities, many of them Christian, are now subject to these tremendous pressures. And to my mind, again, as a medievalist looking at what's going on there, what I see is this tragic situation in which those communities are being squeezed out. They're being forced to, in different ways, to succumb to religious or cultural or political identities which would seek to eradicate their differences. In Egypt, the Coptic Christian community is, as you say, very old. I mean, the Copts claim that their church is the oldest Christian church. They claim that it was founded by the evangelist St. Mark. It goes back, 2,000 years or close to 2,000 years. They represent about 10% of the population, and they are under the current turmoil, subject to a kind of violence and pressure that is really new, to which this community has not been subject in the recent past.
This is this push toward homogenization.
Yeah.
Is this being generated by Islamic fundamentalists?
At the moment, that is the force that is the principal, I would say, driver of this drive towards homogenization. But it's not the only one. The ideology of nationalism, which has been dominant in this part of the world for much of the last century and a half, that was the driving ideology of those authoritarian regimes that we were talking about earlier. Nationalism too imposes a kind of homogeneity of its own. Think, for example, of the experience of Kurds in Turkey, whom the nationalist Turkish government has been reluctant to identify as having their own ethnic or cultural identity, or Armenians in Turkey, or Kurds in Iraq, or Berbers in North Africa. Nationalism, too, was a kind of homogenizing force that tended to squeeze out these identities that were different.
Muhammad in Charlotte writes, "Can your guest shed some light on how Muslims, Jews, and Christians coexisted peacefully only 99 years ago, prior to the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, which was 97 years ago?
Well, I wouldn't sort of point to the Sykes-Picot agreement in particular. That's a kind of a diplomatic thing. It's a very important event having to do with the rise of the modern state system in the Middle East. But to go back a little bit further, in the pre-modern period under Islamic regimes in the Middle Ages, those regimes faced a social situation which, as I said before, was very diverse. You had Muslim communities, but you also had sizable Jewish and Christian communities. And they worked out ways of dealing with the differences between them. It's a long and it's a very complicated story, but basically what happened is that under the terms of Islamic law, Muslim governments would leave the religious minority communities alone to organize their own affairs, to worship in the way that they saw fit, in exchange for which the religious minorities would subject themselves to certain restrictions. So, for example, they would have to pay a head tax, what we would call poll tax maybe, to the Muslim government. They would be forbidden from participating in any way in political institutions. They might be required to wear certain colored clothing, right, so that one could identify easily who was a Jew and who was a Christian and who was a Muslim. An indication, by the way, that there really wasn't much ghettoization, that people were all kind of mixed together. From our modern perspective, this looks really suspect, right, because clearly these people are being treated as second-class citizens. But as a professor of mine in graduate school used to say, well, you know, second-class citizenship is a form of citizenship, and it's not perfect from our modern perspective in which when we embrace an ideal of egalitarianism and equality, right? But before the French Revolution, equality wasn't an issue. Nobody expected to be equal. And by and large, the ways in which Muslims and others in the Middle East before the modern period dealt with this different, the ways worked pretty well. And yes, Jews and Christians were by and large kind of subjected to certain restrictions. They lived restricted lives. They lived the lives of what we would call second-class citizens. But by and large, the tensions between the communities were kept at bay. And by and large, the relations between them were fairly peaceable. Not perfect from a modern perspective at all. But compared to, say, the way in which religious minorities were treated in other cultures, like those of, say, Christian Europe at the time, it was a much, much better system.
Let's talk about Syria. They're involved in a civil war. The Assad family has ruled Syria with an iron fist for decades. Why now?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. I mean, in part, this is just spillover from other upheavals that have gone on in the Arab world.
They got theirs, we want ours.
You know, it started in Tunisia and spread to Egypt and Libya and Bahrain and Yemen, and finally, you know, it burst out in Syria as well. But there's another important factor in Syria that doesn't get a lot of attention in our media, and those are environmental concerns. For the last 6 or 7 years, Syria has experienced a terrible, terrible drought, probably as a result of climate change, of global warming. And one of the consequences of that is that it shattered the agricultural economy in Syria and furthermore drove a lot of people off their farms because there was simply no water, either to water their plants or just to live themselves. People talk now about, you know, the 2 million refugees that have fled the conflict in Syria, fled into Jordan and Turkey and various other places. But some estimates I've seen have suggested that in the 5 years previous to the outbreak of the rebellion, as many as 5 million people were displaced within Syria, having left their farms because those farms were simply no longer viable, and they moved to cities where you know, they placed terrible burdens on economic infrastructure. So I think there's Tom Friedman and others have talked about this a little bit. This is the, in a way, kind of one of the first revolutions that's come about as a consequence of climate change. We may be looking at our future.
So it's not
Syria.
So much of the iron fist as it is.
Well, it is that too. I mean, there's, you know, part of this is a democratic uprising. There's no question. People were terribly frustrated politically with the Assad regime, which was a brutal one. in political terms. And some of this has to do with people's feelings of political frustration. But I think there were economic frustrations and demographic problems that were driven by a wide variety of factors, including environmental ones.
Bashar al-Assad's father was
Hafez.
Mm-hmm. Hafez. He was truly brutal. Was Bashar al-Assad, prior to the Civil War, of course, really brutal?
Well, politically brutal, yes, although he had really kind of opened up cultural space, at least in major centers in Syria, major demographic centers like Damascus. There was a really thriving artistic and cultural community, a pretty vibrant cultural life under Bashar al-Assad's regime in the few years before the outbreak of the uprising. I was in Damascus actually just a few months before the uprising started, and it was an incredibly cosmopolitan place. People were connected to the world. They knew what was going on. The open discussion, not political stuff, right? The politics was kept very, very firmly under wraps by the regime. But in a broader cultural sense, there was a really, really vibrant conversation.
Is that the way he kept – when you talk about the iron fist of Bashar al-Assad, is that he wouldn't allow political discussion? Is that it? Or was there more to it?
Yes, but I think the opening that he gave to people, the economic opening and the cultural opening – mitigated a lot of what otherwise would have been real political frustration. People, you know, it's not everyone, but some people were willing to accept the political repression to stay out of politics in order to live their own cultural and economic
lives.
Was
that repression to keep him and his family in power, or was it because he knew if you opened the door to all these different political voices that you would have chaos?
Well, it's both, but it was really, you know, the Assad regime, insofar as it represents the interests not just of his family and clan, but of the Alawite community, really is you've got a situation in Syria where about 12% say of the population really did monopolize political power and much economic power as well, and to some extent, the resistance on the part of his cronies to any sort of opening to a democratic movement was a fear of losing control.
So how would you characterize this civil war? Is it a rebellion against the dictator? Is it a sectarian conflict? Once again, we see tension between Sunni and Shiite and Alawite. A much larger historical realignment of power, or something else altogether?
It is all of those things. And that's precisely why, you know, we were chatting during the break about policy, why I think the American government and other governments need to be very, very cautious about intervening, because there are so many things going on that it's almost impossible to isolate the various threads and to say with any degree of clarity and assurance that, well, if we do this, this other thing will happen. If we bomb Assad's forces, then this other group, more to our political liking, will come to power. I think it's impossible to make those judgments.
Which is why I think President Obama has stayed out of this for a very long
time.
That and the fact that we have learned some lessons from Iraq. He was against going into war in Iraq, and we now have come to learn that when you break something over there, it is incredibly complicated to try to fix it, if not impossible. But then he did draw this red line against the use of chemical weapons, which they then went ahead, we believe, and used. Was it a mistake to draw the line?
Chemical weapons are a terrible thing, a really, really terrible thing. And it may well be that the international community, not just the United States, but the international community more generally, has a compelling strategic interest in responding forcefully to any use.
But they've decided not to. The Congress went against it. The Parliament in Great Britain went against it. Only France said they would come to our aid in a very limited amount of
Now, as you well know, the politics of all that, our internal politics of all that, are very, very complicated too. But it does seem that they may, that is, our administration may have, in a ham-fisted way, stumbled into what might turn out to be a reasonable conclusion to this, and that would be the Syrian government giving up its stockpile of chemical weapons, which from the standpoint of an international community seeking to limit the use of those weapons would be the ideal outcome.
And Russia is brokering the deal, and Russia was against our going in. Why?
Well, the Russians are longstanding supporters of the Syrian
regime.
Yes,
why?
Well, it goes back to the days of the Cold War and the Israeli-Arab dispute being kind of a proxy for American and Soviet competition in the Middle East. And what happened over the last 30 or 40 years, really since the end of the 67 war, is that all of the Soviets' former clients in the region have either collapsed or, you know, gone over to the other side, Egypt being the classic case of that. Egypt, too, was more or less a Soviet client state until the mid-1970s. It's now one of our closest allies in the region, and the Syrians are all that the Russians have left in
but,
the region.
But again, oil and gas, does that play a role in this? Because Russia has oil and gas and
yeah, I think not so much directly. I think what Russia, I think Russia's interest in Syria and in the region, they have a major naval base in Syria, one of the few that they have outside of Russia proper. That's a major consideration. And it also has a lot to do with just saving face, I think, and preserving the one regime that has been more or less loyal to Moscow through the years.
Gary on the web writes, the nations of the Middle East have disliked one another for hundreds of years. There's no way any outside nation can solve these problems. The Middle East has to solve it on its own, and that assumes that they even want to solve them. We should stay out of it. They have no concept of personal liberty, and their primary desire is to destroy anyone who doesn't agree with them. I say leave them alone. They are classic examples of peoples who have never learned anything from the past and most likely never will. Is that a gross generalization?
Well, I agree with the conclusion, the policy conclusion, which is that we should stay out of things. But it does kind of mischaracterize reality on the ground and historical reality in the Middle East. The notion, for example, that there's no sense of personal liberty, this flies in the face of one of the major themes of Islamic law, which is very, very respectful of individuals. And
why do we have that impression? I only have 15 seconds. Why do we have that impression?
Because there is a long history of contact and conflict between our Christian West and the Muslim world, and that hostility has bred real mistrust and misunderstanding
and
our part.
And it dates back to the Middle
East.
And
it goes back a long, long way, yes.
Dr. Jonathan Berkey, the James B. Duke Professor of International Studies, Chair of the History Department at Davidson College, and the author of The Formation of Islam, as well as Shattered Mosaic, the Middle East Since the Rise of Islam, which will be coming out
soon.
Thanks for the hour.